alienation and loneliness, and then bring his ideas into conversation, first briefly with certain existential thinkers, and then more with Rabbi David Hartman. I'm going to focus on Rabbi Hartman's anguished critique of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and their argument is much more than just a semantic dispute about language. It's rather a fundamental disagreement about essential questions. For example, what's the real meaning of the words exile and alienation? What is the best life to be living as a Jew and as a human being? Are exile and alienation a permanent feature of being human, or are they a social construct? Is friendship meaningful in a world of loneliness? Can learning Torah divert you from properly contributing to the world that you live in? Is the halakha in exile, so to speak, and can or should be brought back into redemption? And what is the nature of Jewish redemption? Now, obviously, a thorough investigation of these questions is well beyond my purview here, but what I'm going to try and do is create at least a prologue for that discourse. And at the end of the talk, I'll offer some thoughts of my own on the different and complex kinds of exiles from which we all suffer and their implication for the lives that we live. So, as all of you know, historically, when Jews talked about exile, it was often a geographic reference, historically understood in relation to the dream of a return to the land of Israel. And today, of all days, we remember the fact in the wake of the two destructions of the temple, nearly 2,000 years of the loss of sovereignty. So the modern return to the land is the very definition of the end of Galut, is prominent among many figures in religious Zionism, and perhaps foremost among them is Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. You know, Rav Tzvi Yehuda lived in a tiny apartment not that far from here in Geula, and on one of the walls is a picture of his father, Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cook. Also his grandfather, the renowned Torah scholar Yad Deret, and also a photograph of another bearded Jew, which was Theodore Herzl. Was on one wall, and on the other wall he had a photograph, which was the sunrise coming up over a mountain, and there was a caption underneath the photo, and it said, "So too unfolds the redemption of Israel, in the beginning, little by little." Now, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, if you asked him about Galut, was actually completely bewildered by the fact that Jews continued to live chutz la'aretz. He, in fact, called that kind of Galut a total aberration. And he said, in our normal, healthy state, we need to be here, the entire nation of Israel, in the land of Israel. It's very instructive to compare that sentiment with the worldview of Rav Soloveitchik. Now, Rav Soloveitchik was fully aware of the connection between exile and a political or historical narrative, the narrative I just talked about, the loss of the temples, loss of sovereignty. But while he was aware of that, consistently reiterates that alienation informs the essence of what it means to be alive, not just outside of Israel, but to be alive. And that it is a permanent feature of our condition, and that Galut is actually an inherent human experience, not simply or even largely a loss of political sovereignty. So let's begin to look at what he has to say. I'm going to ask you to keep your sheets close again, because we're going to be looking at them fairly regularly. Let's look at source number one. He writes, from an existential, metaphysical perspective, exile is a universal experience. Our exile is but a reflection of the general metaphysical consciousness of exile oppressing every human being, and not only the Jew. Man was cursed by God and sent away from Eden as a homeless creature. Now we'll come back to the expulsion from Eden a little bit later, but when you talk about Galut in this fashion, you leave behind the timeline of recorded events, and you place in grave doubt the ability of any historical action, even one as significant as the rebirth of the state of Israel, to fully redeem this condition. So there are two ways, therefore, at least two ways of thinking about Galut. One is a temporary political circumstance that can be overturned by the return to Eretz Israel. And the second one, which he seems to be going towards, This is a metaphysical or existential fate of human beings upon earth that has existed since the expulsion from Gan Eden and that cannot be negated through any political or historical solution. So when Rabbi Soloveitchik traces the origins of alienation, he invokes the double creation story that we're all familiar with from the beginning of Sefer Bereishit, right? There's a certain way that human beings are created in the first parak and a different way that they're created in the second parak. And he distinguishes between two mythical human archetypes, what he calls Adam 1 and Adam 2. You could also say Eve 1 and Eve 2. I'm going to simplify matters greatly here, but to summarize, Adam 1 focuses on mastering his environment, using technology and science, all the skill sets that we've come to admire after the Enlightenment. He calls this majestic man. The second Adam, much more inward, seeks a covenantal relationship with God, finds himself by succumbing to God's will. And they're not sort of split apart. There's a dialectical relation between the two Adams, between the two people here. What he calls the continuous movement between the pole of natural majesty, Adam 1, and the covenantal humility, Adam 2. Both Adams, the Rabbi Soloveitchik, are necessary in God's world. It's not just like Mr. or Mrs. Spirituality is it. He wants both of them. But even though he definitely perceives dignity and he perceives beauty and Adam 1's technological mastery of the world, and he also sees that as divinely mandated, he clearly emphasizes Adam 2, the more profound sort of search that's taking place inside of him, pursuing the deeper spiritual quest, and therefore finds himself estranged from the Adam 1 type, which is the dominant type. So for us, where the salvation is going through is he's saying, when he looks around, right, when he wrote Lonely Man of Faith in 1965, he looked around and he felt lonely. He felt lonely because he felt like the kind of person he was, the kind of things that preoccupied him were not shared by his peers. That most people were going after, you know, success and some sort of drive for power, and the spiritual man was left kind of on his own. And once the spiritual man realizes this, there's a self-realization that comes with Adam 2, and actually that leads to a kind of downward spiral. In this recognition of loneliness lies the seeds of complete estrangement from his peers. In other words, to be this way, to be Adam 2, is to be different than others, and to be different than others is finally to be alone. And that's what he tells us in source number 2. He says the following. The I awareness which Adam 2 attains brings the awareness of his exclusiveness and ontological incompatibility with any other being. Each great redemptive step forward in man's quest for humanity entails the ever-growing, tragic awareness of his aloneness and onlyness, and consequently of his loneliness and insecurity. He struggles for the discovery of his identity because he suffers from the insecurity implied in seeing the icy darkness of uniformity and irresponsiveness, and gazing into that senseless something without being awarded a reciprocal gaze. He has no companion with whom to communicate, and therefore he is existentially insecure. So you can see that that sort of very dense philosophical language carries a real emotional wallop. Right? Look at the sort of ontological incompatibility, aloneness, and onlyness, no companion with whom to communicate, and so on. So once you're aware that you are a unique self, the immediate resonance is that others are not like you and never can be. So Adam 1 and Adam Eve 1, if you like, or you and I, are lonely. Despite, right, he says this, despite all of our friends and acquaintances and colleagues and contacts, despite desperate attempts to fill our days with all manner of distraction and busyness, and poignantly, even despite the people in our lives that we genuinely love and are loved. because the rough soul of aging, our deepest feelings and experiences are in the end not truly communicable, as he tells us in source number 3. To be means to be the only one, singular and different and consequently lonely, because there is no one who exists like the I, and because the modus existentiae, the mode of existence of the I, cannot be repeated, imitated, or experienced by others. Now, you take this set of facts and you present them to different people, and for some people, that provokes a deep sense of uneasiness, but not for all of us, just for some of us. A feeling, I guess, that life is stripped of any purpose, that our days are a facade hiding really the unthinkable. And it's interesting that Rabbi Soloveitchik speaks of this unflinchingly, does not blink, as you see in source number 4. We are aware that our lives commence and will be terminated without our consent. We lack faith in the justifiability of our existence. This is a metaphysical experience, not merely psychological or rational. A pervasive meaninglessness, purposelessness, and an absurdity of life convey themselves to the introspective, sensitive person. The end is important, right? Because I noted a moment ago that this uneasiness, this brooding about meaning, is the province of only some of us. In Rav Soloveitchik's words, to the introspective, sensitive person. So the more you allow yourself as a human being to full and unrepressed and emotionally complex view of the depths of life, so for him, the more you're going to tune in to the potential sadness that lies just below the surface of the day. And I want you all, including myself, to think about what he's saying here. Right? Think about the people that you know in your life. In normal society, we tend to kind of steer away from, or even at times mock, the person who is too intense, too raw, too existentially aware, the one who will not turn their eyes away from stark emotional truths. We tease them, worse, we shun them, because in actuality, we are frightened by their ability to face what we cannot face, to encounter with honesty what we do not. And you can see this differentiation throughout Rabbi Soloveitchik's work between the sensitive as opposed to the relatively out-of-touch person. For instance, in his well-known comments about whether tefillah is obligated by biblical law, there's an argument among the Rishonim about whether the mitzvah to pray comes from the Torah or from the rabbis. Right. The Rambam and the Ramban disagree famously about this. The Rambam says that daily tefillah is a mitzvah, mitzaraita, a mitzvah that's singing in the Torah. And the Ramban, Nachmanides, argues that the mitzvah is rabbinic, and it only becomes a Torah mitzvah in times of acute distress. And it shifts actually its source, its grounding, and becomes a mitzvah d'oraita. Now, when he attempts to reconcile the positions of the Rambam and the Ramban, Rabbi Soloveitchik takes the opportunity again to allude to this vast gulf between the sensitive and the oblivious soul. Take a look at source number 5. He writes, both, referring here both to Rambam and Ramban, both regard prayer as meaningful only if it is derived from a sense of sarat, distress. They differ in their understanding of the word. Maimonides regarded daily life itself as being existentially in straits, inducing in the sensitive person feelings of despair, a brooding sense of life's meaninglessness, absurdity, lack of fulfillment. It is persistent sarah, which exists b'chol yom, daily. Thus, while Nachmanides dealt only with surface crisis, sarot tzibur, or public distress, Maimonides regarded all life as a death crisis. It's really very hard to miss, especially when you go deeper and deeper into Rabbi Soloveitchik's canon and his reflections on absurdity,
Hard
to miss the influence of the major existential thinkers, Sartre, Camus, and especially Kierkegaard. And if you take a look in source number 6, Kierkegaard's summation of life in his work Repetition, this is a very small piece of what's a very long piece. Kierkegaard writes, "I stick my finger into existence and it smells of nothing. Where am I? Who am I? How came I here? What is this thing called the world? What does this world mean? Who is it that has lured me into the world? Why was I not consulted? And if I'm to be compelled to take part in it, where's the director? Is there no director? Whither shall I turn with my complaint?" So very, very famous words in the sort of ongoing discourse of existentialism, right, back in the 1840s. And what's striking is, compare what we just read, which is Kierkegaard's kind of fierce suspicion of the nullity of the world, with Adam II's own musings in The Holy Man of Faith. In source number 7, he says, he wants to know, why is it? What is it? Who is it? He wonders, why did the world in its totality come into existence? Why is man confronted by this stupendous and indifferent order of things and events? Very, very kind of parallel language going on there. So these are momentous questions, ones that locate human exile well outside of the boundaries or vicissitudes of politics or geography. They're not going to go away. They're not going to evaporate on a nefesh for nefesh on the upfront. They're still going to be there. Take my word for it. So you say to yourself, okay, so what's the difference? So I think that for Rav Soloveitchik, their bleakness is only alleviated by the promise of divine salvation. It's contingent on human surrender. It's that element, of course, that would fundamentally separate Rav Soloveitchik from respective of Sartre and Camus and others. If you think about Camus, Adam Gopnik once wrote very sharply of Camus. The big question Camus asked was never the Anglo-American liberal one, how can we make the world a little bit better tomorrow? It was rather the grander French one, why not kill yourself tonight? And that is Camus' question, right? Those of you who've read The Myth of Sisyphus, that's what Camus writes. He says that there's really only one serious philosophical question, and that is suicide. Right? He means it. And that is not. That is not Rabbi Soloveitchik's question. On the other hand, he understands the question. He's not oblivious to the question. He knows exactly where Camus is going with this question. He just doesn't go there. Why does he go there? Because halakhic man is not l'étranger. You know, he's not the man with no sense of purpose at all, and the person who just engenders random acts of nihilism. So you do have a real paradox in Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings, and I might speculate in his life, because he affirms alienation and absurdity as legitimate spiritual and psychic categories. And he argues that no amount of material mastery, no amount of conquest or pseudo-power can obscure the basic facts of our fragility, our temporariness, and hence our anxiety, our dread. Despite this, he does not adopt the stance of the atheistic side of existentialism. Professor Avi Saki, over at Bar Ilan, pointed out that Rabbi Soloveitchik assumes that the desire for transcendence, the reaching out for God, is a basic human need, and that alienation ensues actually when we don't fulfill this need, when it goes unsatisfied. So that even if absurdity is a fact for Rabbi Soloveitchik, the absurd for him is the potential gateway to God, ironically. So put another way, he converts the tragic into the transcendent. And he notes that when human beings come upon the absurd in life, what they're actually getting at that moment is they're apprehending the vision of a hidden God. So in existential galut, which is really what he's talking about, the longing for and reaching out for something beyond the human, that's the only thing that can bring you home. not rendering the source of alienation, it's distance from God, and it doesn't matter where you live. You could be in the remotest part of the diaspora, you could be at the heart of Jerusalem in the same situation. Even so, even with the suggestion that you reach out for God at the times of the greatest absurdity, by no means ever does Rabbi Soloveitchik make an easy equation between this reaching out for God and the fact, the idea that your life is suddenly going to get so much easier, that it's going to lighten your earthly burden. Even with all the richness and depth of Jewish life, it's not going to redeem us from bewilderment, from incomprehensibility, from pain. And we'll still have many, many questions that will go unanswered and will remain unanswered as long as we live. And he is, in fact, that Judaism will not offer, does not offer, any easy solace that many of us might seek and even expect from it. So if you take a look at source number 8, this is a rather early essay that he wrote in 1945. This is a piece of it. He says, very striking actually, when you think about what people expect from religion, what Rav Soloveitchik writes here. He says, the error of modern representatives of religion is that they promise their congregants the solution to all the problems of life, an expectation that religion does not fulfill. Religion, on the contrary, deepens the problems, but never intends to solve them. When a minister, rabbi, or priest attempts to solve the ancient question of Job's suffering through a sermon or lecture, he does not promote religious ends. To the contrary, he does them a disservice. Kedusha, holiness, Kedusha elevates man, not by vouchsafing him harmony and synthesis, balance and proportionate thinking, but by revealing to him the non-rationality and insolubility of the riddle of existence. Kedusha is not a paradise, but a paradox. So you do have clear comparisons with Kierkegaard's repeated criticisms of Christianity in the 19th century. You saw Christianity is too comfortable and too bourgeois. And there are ostensible points of resemblance between Kierkegaard and the Rout, but you know, I wouldn't push it too far. There's really limits to these analogies. You see in source number 9, Rav Soloveitchik himself, aware of the comparison, sharply dismisses the comparison, because he sees Kierkegaard as kind of privileging an isolationist faith experience, and he writes, the halakhic world of faith consists of feeling become thought, and that experience be acted out and transformed into an objective event. Kierkegaard's existentialist world is a place of silence and passivity, far removed from the complex array of historical events, not hungering for action or movement. So he is arguing here that the halakhic man, even the halakhic existentialist, is different from Kierkegaard's night of faith, because the halakhic man confronts absurdity by defiantly clinging to Jewish law, and he connects that law to the world he lives in. In other words, he's part of the world, right? He doesn't just withdraw to a corner. He's got to do meat smoke. He's got to be operating. That's the argument here. It's very interesting that the very language that Rabbi Soloveitchik uses to criticize Kierkegaard, to affirm the difference between a halakhic life and an alienated life, that's the language that Rabbi Hartman seizes on to develop an entirely different view of alienation. And I want to turn to that now. David Hartman's career was consistently marked by his engagement and struggle with his teacher's ideas. And in many instances, his rejection of Rav Soloveitchik's premises, both in his understanding of exile as well as his conception of how Jews should relate to the world, Rabbi Hartman offers a counterview to that of Rav Soloveitchik. So, for instance, regarding the passage we just saw, Rabbi Hartman argues that there is a deep irony in Rav Soloveitchik's assessment that Kierkegaard's man of faith is removed from worldly things. Because for Rabbi Hartman, he believes that that's precisely the habitual weakness of the halakhic man himself. He's too removed from the world. Now, to support his own argument, Rav Soloveitchik in the book Halakhic Man offers up the example of his own grandfather, famous for Heinrich Rist. And his view of his grandfather is of this primary example of this kind of activist person who's involved in his community as he says in source number 10, which we'll take a look at now. Talking to Refiant, he writes, constantly in debt, he gave most of his salary to the poor, and in the winter he would leave his wood store unlocked, so that the poor of the town could take the fuel they needed without the embarrassment of having to ask. It was impossible, he said, for him to light a fire in his own home. He knew that in other homes the poor were freezing. Now, Rabbi Hartman accuses Rav Soloveitchik of creating a distorted paradigm of a halachic man that's truly involved in the world, since he's just basing it on a few scattered and therefore misleading instances of his grandfather helping people in his community. And he really goes after it in source number 11 from his book, The Living Covenant. Do such examples suffice to justify the seemingly exaggerated claim that the halachic man is a mighty activist, transforming the world, entering into the concrete, fighting the causes of social injustice? What worlds did the halachic man create? Was he in the forefront of social endeavors to transform the economic injustices of the world? Although the examples of the personal morality of Soloveitchik's grandfather show the latter to have been a courageous defender of halachic propriety, examples on a far greater scale would be needed to confirm Soloveitchik's claim for the activism of halachic men. The fact that all the commandments deal with the real world could have suggested to Soloveitchik that halachic man is committed to deal with this world seriously, but then he would need to face the fact that learning can be a form of spiritual alienation, that intellectual discussion of mitzvot about this world can be a substitute for taking the world seriously. It is possible for learning to become not an expression of one's yearning to act, but a mental construction that enables one to escape the complexities of the real world. That intellectual involvement in Torah study might be a source of alienation from the real world is not given serious consideration in Soloveitchik's essay. So two issues emerge here in this critique. Number one, Rabbi Hartman is perturbed and more by what he sees as the resignation that ensues when alienation is categorized by Rav Soloveitchik as a species condition of humanity, and therefore inevitable, right? If you say that this is how it is, people from the birth to the, to the cradle to the grave are just existentially alienated, nothing to do about it, and I've come off from other people, that really annoys Rabbi Hartman. Because if you see it that way, as opposed to a condition that's actually created and solvable by human beings and their failure to relate to one another properly. So that's the first critique. The second critique is he's obviously calling out what he sees as a fraudulent claim to the activism of the halachic hero. So let's flesh it out a bit, right? Where you have thinkers like Sartre and Camus and Rav Soloveitchik infer alienation as an unavoidable feature of being alive, someone like Karl Marx, for example, sees this alienation as a product of the class society in general, of capitalism in particular, that we can end this pervasive alienation of human beings from each other and from themselves by radically reorganizing our socioeconomic systems. I'm just using this as a point of comparison. Take a look at source 12 from the Economic Manuscripts, page 24. This is Marx. We have to grasp the intrinsic connection between private property, greed, the separation of labor, of value, and the devaluation of man. Do not let us go back to a fictitious primordial condition. Such a primordial condition explains nothing. It merely pushes the question away into a great nebulous distance. Thus, the theologian explains the origin of evil by the fall of man, that is, he assumes as a fact, in historical form, what still has to be explained. We proceed from an actual economic fact. Now, I'm definitely not here to discuss Marx's critique of capitalism. I've had enough of that in college. And certainly Rabbi Hartman is not a Marxist. But his comments that we saw before do really parallel Marx's irritation with the notion of some sort of primordial human condition as the source of alienation, which then becomes a way of escaping having to deal with real social injustice. Robert Hartman's stinging rebuke of the potential passivity in the culture of Torah study completely rewrites Russell Bage's use of the term alienation, which for Robert Hartman is not some sort of metaphysical, unchanging curse. It's rather the byproduct of the daily choice that people make every day. In other words, for him, learning Torah can become a means of withdrawing from reality and the concerns of other people, and that becomes alienation from your fellow human being. I guess if you put it another way, when does all this talk about ontological loneliness simply become an excuse not to do your bit for humanity? This is not a small criticism. For one thing, it would mean that the picture of a potentially ideal Jewish form of life, right, unceasing Torah learning day and night, could instead be construed as insular and irresponsible. One can feel on a visceral level that I heard is attempting to pierce through what he sees as Rob Soloveitch's kind of mystification of core parts of the human experience. Because if loneliness and alienation are permanent, then no one can really understand me, and I don't need to seek to be understood, and I don't need to seek to engage with you. So, for example, Rabbi Hartman takes this critique and focuses in on one part of where he thinks Rav Soloveitch uses it to his detriment. The belief that loneliness becomes an essential feature of the man of faith is used by Rav Soloveitch to justify his decision prohibiting the Orthodox community from engaging in religious dialogue with other faith communities. This is from Rav Soloveitch's essay called Confrontation in Source 13. The word of faith reflects the intimate, the private, the paradoxically inexpressible cravings of the individual for and his linking up with his maker. It reflects the numinous character and strangeness of the act of faith of a particular community which is totally incomprehensible to the man of a different faith community. Hence, it is important that the religious or theological logos of the word should not be employed as a medium of communication between two faith communities. The contribution should occur not at a theological, but at a mundane human level. There, all of us speak the universal language of modern man. Or to put it in the language you saw before, you can encounter non-Jewish believers as Adam 1, but not as Adam 2. Our only connection with the other, as other, must be in the mundane realm of earthly matters, the domain of politics or business and so on. We can't share or discuss or compare our deepest spiritual experiences with other religious communities. So again, Rabbi Hartman, who does agree with Rav Soloveitchik on the value of Torah study and does agree and embrace a particularistic Jewish way of life, but he charges that the inner life of Rav Soloveitchik's heroic ideal is, quote, hermetically sealed off from the rest of human life. And if you look at Source 14, he is unstinting in his criticism of the potentially corrupting effects of such a view. He writes, when the faith experience is insulated from outside criticism, there's a risk of moral sloppiness and religious arrogance. People can feel self-righteous and morally secure in their private faith language if they believe their community is the repository of the absolute truth. When the faith community has been insulated from and is unresponsive to rational criticism, there is nothing that cannot be justified in the name of tradition. And Rabbi Hartman's condemnation extends to his uneasiness about the Rav's consistent dichotomizing of Judaism and the West. More often than not, you've seen Rav Soloveitchik's writing, there's a kind of radical polarity in either kind of God intoxication or this ever-present possibility of a wasted, non-God-centered life. As he says in Source 15, Judaism declares that man stands at the crossroads and wonders about the path he shall take. Before him, there is an awesome alternative: the image of God or the beast of prey, the crown of creation or the bogey of existence, the noblest of creatures or the degenerate creature. So caught therefore between the lure of earthly drives and the demand of divine service, Salvation asserts that we have a critical choice to make about whom and what we serve. And if you look in Source 16, he utterly denies the ability of Western culture to create a meaningful moral paradigm without God. And he argues this somewhat, I would say, contentiously. He writes, in a secular state, virtue and moral society, can a culture which is indifferent to the transcendental imperative inspire ethical performance in private or public life? In past decades, secular humanists were certain that man could be induced and motivated to pursue ethical norms without the absolute imperative of the divine. But our thesis is that in the long run, and for the masses of society, there can be no such thing. Either man accepts the authority of God as the legislator of the moral norm, or he will eventually fail in all attempts to create a moral society. A relativistic, man-made moral order will simply not endure. And the inability of modern secularism to motivate ethical behavior in private or public life is evidence of this truth, right? Very strident, unequivocal, and a dogmatic take on Western culture. That kind of sweeping dismissal of Western life and morality leads to the following response in Source 17 by Rabbi Hartman. Soloveitchik seeks to justify the faith posture of loneliness by making severe ad hominem attacks on majestic across Western culture. Western spiritual persons of the majestic faith temperament, claims Soloveitchik, subordinate faith to transient interests in their demonic quest for dominion. They are completely claimed by utilitarian interests. Their faith commitment does not understand the meaning of sacrifice or unconditional commitment, but is concerned with convenience. At the center of their cultural edifice lies the quest for success and the gratification of human needs. All these ad hominem accusations make it easier for the halakhic community not to respond to what would be serious moral criticism. If one can cast aspersions on the integrity and sincerity of all outsiders, it is not a serious problem if one is not understood. Soloveitchik's accusatory style, therefore, can be used by observant Jews to ignore criticism by priding themselves on the fact that they alone live in the realm of the unchangeable in the eternal quest for redemption. Now, obviously part of the problem in any such debate between people who are alive and people who are not, or people who are alive and people at that time are very ill, there's no chance for reciprocity. I personally am not actually sure that Rabbi Soloveitchik would recognize or even concede to this dismissal of the halakhic or the lonely man as antisocial or alienated from his fellow human being and not willing to talk. It could be, though, that the form that the halakhic man's help would take is not sort of storming the barricades of social justice, but is instead ensconced in traditional halakhic categories, for instance, that of prayer. Take a look at Source 18, for instance. So, for Rav Soloveitchik, concern for the other in the halakhic realm would be, for instance, making sure that you help others by consistently thinking about and being aware of them in prayer and pleading their cause. As he writes, the prayerful community must not remain a twofold affair. Transient eye addressing itself to the eternal he. The inclusion of others is indispensable. Man should avoid praying for himself alone. The foundation of efficacious and noble prayer is human solidarity and sympathy, and the covenantal awareness of existential togetherness, of sharing and experiencing the travail and suffering of those for whom majestic Adam the First has no concern. In the same way, as he really defines a different terrain for what it means to care about another person, right? A terrain that he is mapping along the lines of Adam too, he also approaches friendship in much the same way. He asserts, controversially, that real communion between people can only take place within a spiritual as opposed to a secular framework. But within that framework, relationships are possible, They are beneficial and they are imperative, as he says in source 19. Friendship, not as a surface relation, but as an existential in-depth relation between two individuals, is realizable only within the framework of the covenantal community, where in-depth personalities relate themselves to each other ontologically. And total commitment to God and fellow man is the order of the day. In the majestic community, Adam 1, in which service personalities need and commitment never exceeds the bounds of the utilitarian, we may find collegiality, neighborliness, civility, or courtesy, but not friendship, which is the exclusive experience awarded by God to covenantal man, who is thus redeemed from his agonizing solitude. There are people who are going to agree with that, and there are people who are definitely not going to agree with that. For Rav Soloveitchik, the movement, right, out of isolation, paradigm for that movement is God. So God moved out of his own loneliness, in Mount Sinai to move human beings. That was his gesture to us, and becomes the model for us to reach out to one another out of our loneliness. So he doesn't have a black and white attitude to human relations. He acknowledges, obviously, the ultimate mystery within each person and the cosmic solitude that ensues from that, but he does believe that there's meaningful communication between people that can help to alleviate their loneliness and create a partial and important redemption of one's life. But he obviously circumscribes those connections within certain kinds of covenantal boundaries, right? But he does talk about friendship, if you look at source 20, as a redeeming thing through the figures of Adam and Eve, each alone, each hidden, but mutually caring, when he says, while mutually revealing themselves to God in prayer, an unqualified commitment, they also reveal themselves to each other in sympathy and love on the one hand, and in common action on the other. Now, whether this is a mythical picture is not relevant. It's his use of Adam and Eve as the paradigm for that kind of redemption that we can bring into our lives that is significant. He doesn't overstate the case ever. He never thinks that relationship is automatic salvation. Right? Which is an interesting thing to think about on its own, that if you think that another person is the one to save your life, Rav Soloveitchik, you are badly, badly mistaken. Right? He really writes that nobody can truly save another person. The impetus for redemption is always self-initiated. As he says in source 21, Judaism has always held that it lies within one's power to renew oneself, to redirect the course of his life. In this task, man must rely upon himself. No one can help him. He is his own creator and innovator. He is his own redeemer. So the picture here of a kind of Emersonian self-reliance, both empowering and yet sobering, in its direct charge that every individual is responsible alone for their own ultimate fate. But for Rabbi Hartman, it would appear that Rav's dichotomies between Adam 1 and Adam 2, between religious and secular, between Jew and non-Jew, this divvying up of the world, is just not in sync with Rabbi Hartman's own kind of postmodern pluralist consciousness. And Rabbi Hartman laments what he sees as his teacher's inability to fully embrace the halakhic possibilities and insights of modernity, as well as the Zionist project. So I'm going to give the following example. It's a very complex example. I'm certainly not competent to judge it, but it will place in sharp relief the argument between the two. So in 1975, there was a controversy that erupted at the Rabbinical Council of America's Academic Convention. Rabbi Emanuel Rachman got up, and he proposed a solution to the Agunah problem. Agunah, a woman whose husband will not grant her a divorce, and hence they are chained to the man to whom they do not wish to remarry. So Rabbi Rachman floated the idea that in many such cases we could free the woman by relying on a retroactive annulment of the condition. In other words, she doesn't need a divorce because she was never married. What was his logic? His logic was that had the woman known in the first place, certain things about the man she was about to marry, that he was cruel, that he wouldn't under any circumstances offer get, etc., she never would have married him. Therefore, the marriage is a mistaken transaction. It's called in halacha mekach ta'ut, literally a false purchase. Now, sounds like a good proposal. The problem with Rabbi Rapin's proposal, which he was acutely aware of, was that there is a standing presumption in the Talmud, anybody who's learned Kiddushin, especially the second year, Kiddushin, there's a standing presumption called a chazakah on the part of the Talmudic sages that a woman would prefer any kind of marriage than to be alone. This is known in Talmudic parlance as tap lemeitiv tandu lemeitiv anu. Literally, it's better to live as two than to be a living widow. In other words, she would prefer connection under any circumstances. Now, Rabbi Rapin felt that this ancient presumption no longer related to the actual condition and feelings of modern women, that they would not rather be married under any circumstances. However, Rav Soloveitchik stood up at the convention and harshly rebuked Rabbi Rapin's proposal and refused to allow the Talmud's presumption to be replaced. He denied that it was an historicized product of antiquity, and he said that Talmudic chazakot were indestructible. Take a look now at source 22. He would not allow the presumption to be overruled as a means of freeing women in the Agudat cases. I feel like saying, you know, what they do on TV, like, warning for the viewer. Here it comes. The chazakah is not based upon sociological factors, but upon a verse in Bereishit, "I will greatly multiply your pain," this is Hashem talking to Chava, "and your desire shall be for your husband, and he will rule over you." It is a metaphysical curse rooted in the feminine personality. She suffers incomparably more than the male, rather than solitude. Solitude to the male is not as terrible an experience, as horrifying an experience, as solitude to a woman. And this will never change. It's an existential fact. It's not due to the status of the woman, but it's due to the difference, to the basic distinction between the female personality and the male personality. This was true in antiquity. It is still true. And it will be true 8,000 years from now. Towards the end of his life, really, Yalom for dying, Rabbi Rapin published a couple of books. He was ill at the time, co-published them, and in one of the penultimate book, The God of Big Lies, he published an account of this, and he then published his response, which we'll read now in source 23. A Soloveitchik student pondering this pivotal episode in American Orthodoxy, I must confess, both puzzlement and great disappointment. Source of motivation, I am in total disagreement with this perception of Torah. The notion of an unchanging presumption of how human beings live their lives might seem dubious under any circumstances. Making that presumption a paradigm for understanding women in the modern condition stretches credibility to a breaking point. I have a strong intuition that Soloveitchik felt traditional Orthodoxy was losing ground against secular culture in the marketplace of ideas, and can only survive by creating a barrier against having it be subject to comparative cultural studies and historical critique. But what is the price paid for this permanence? And who are the personalities and cultures it produces? Something occurs to me. When you first look at what Rabbi Soloveitchik says, and then you look at Rabbi Hartman's response, it sort of feels, if you're anywhere middle to left of Orthodoxy, like low-hanging fruit. Like, it just seems like an awkward, embarrassing statement in the convention, and then Rabbi Hartman makes the obvious kind of rejoinder that many modern people think. But it occurred to me that, again, Rabbi Soloveitchik would be bewildered, and so would supporters of his, right? This is the man, if you were to attack his credentials, read the status of women, right? This is the man who revolutionized women's Talmud. that he instigated at the Maimonides School in Boston long before it was fashionable. And just as vehemently, I think, advocates of Robert Herman's approach would say that Rumsfeld was emblematic of why halakha was paralyzed and unable to make bold changes regarding a number of subjects. Just to give one last example of this disconnect, the Zionist rebirth, right? Should that make a difference? Should halakha change in relation to the fact that Jews returned to the land of Israel? There's a similar dynamic that plays out between Rav Soloveitchik and Rabbi Herman's desire to move ahead versus Rav Soloveitchik's caution. And of course, there are differences, you know, one made Aliyah, one didn't. But interestingly, again, it's Rav Soloveitchik who urges his American co-religionists in the 1950s to perceive history when it's right in front of them, his passionate remarks about the return of sovereignty in language that really echoes, ironically, Rabbi Herman's complaints about Orthodox passivity. There's this famous essay called The Deed of Fech, where Rav Soloveitchik traces six knocks that God makes on the door of Jews, alerting them to this unprecedented miracle, right? Political miracle, military, theological, swayed the hearts of assimilated Jews, it's brought salvation for people who need a safe haven. Look what he writes in Source 24. If you didn't know, could have been Rabbi Herman who wrote it. He says, "Woe unto the beneficiary of a miracle he does not recognize. The miracle performed on his behalf. He is deaf to the metaphysical imperative. It stands to reason then that when the possibility arose for the Jewish people to return to its land, the land that had withheld its treasures from strangers and guarded them for us, Orthodox Jews would eagerly bestir themselves to perform this great and important mitzvah. Alas, we did not act thus." And just for purposes of constraint, I left out the rest of the page, which he goes even further, you know, criticizing Orthodox passivity. Depends how you want to look at it. If you want to look at it from 2015, you can say, you know, Rav Soloveitchik just doesn't seem up to it. Because a lot has changed since 1957. But it is actually a remarkable stance to take, given his family legacy and where he came from. Right? Rav Soloveitchik recalls that in his own house, his father's house, his parents' ancestors, right, very, very famous within a dynasty, his teachers and his colleagues were, quote, far from the Mizrahi religious Zionists. I think he's being understated. That is a good deal of anti-Zionist from where he came. And he says that when he supported Mizrahi and became basically a Zionist, it took a big toll on his relationships. He says, quote, "Jews like me are required to sacrifice on this altar their peace of mind as well as their social relations and friendships." So I think, you know, in Judaism, like in life, it's perfectly valid to disagree with the worldview of another person, to act in a way that your conscience thinks is best. It's also important to judge people within their context and to avoid anachronistic criticism. So I think just like it's legitimate for a person to believe the Jewish law should change in relation to contemporary status of women, it could change radically. But at the same time, it's probably silly to complain, quote, that Chazal were not feminists, unquote. So too, it's important to recognize that Rav Soloveitchik's familial context was a long, long way from the kind of pro-Zionist tendencies that many people in this room, myself among them, take for granted. To say what he does and hold it to debate is actually a remarkable reversal of the Doppelgänger of his natural surface. So to go further and criticize him and not following up on his activist remarks, move to Israel or see Aliyah as the mitzvah par excellence, maybe it's to impose upon him a context that wasn't his. Because he was kind of moderate, right? He was aware. He wasn't the Rav Kook school, right? Kind of messianic Zionism. Not sympathetic to Haredim either. He tried to find a place in between. As you see very clearly in Source 25, this is a letter he wrote many years ago. There is a third halachic approach, which is neither parallel to the position of those whose eyes are shut and reject the significance of the state, nor the belief of those dreamers who adopt a completely positive stance to the point where they identify the state with the fulfillment of the highest goal of our historical and meta-historical destiny. This third approach would be positively inclined toward the state and would express gratitude for its establishment out of a sense of love, but would not attach to an excessive value to the point of its glorification and deification. Okay, so it's kind of trying to find its way in between. But again, Rabbi Hartman, the Zionist rebirth, has the potential for a much bolder halakhic reaction to events as they're occurring in real time. I mean, later he told a very interesting anecdote, which is published in the introduction to this book of Hartman that he wrote. Rabbi Hartman was a Canadian among us. Rabbi Hartman had a pulpit in Montreal to BJ, and then he came to Israel for the Six-Day War, and after the Six-Day War, you know, people are dancing in the streets, and it's still kind of odd, you know, to Shabbat, talking about the morning of July, and that really made an impression on him. Right? So he goes back home to Montreal, sees everybody sitting on the floor, like this morning, and he's bewildered. Like, the liturgy, right, keynote, and also the kinds of insurgents we make in Yom Kippur, just don't seem to match the experience of living it as an actual Jew. Right? So he comes to Rav Soloveitchik, he made Aliyah in 1971, comes to Rav Soloveitchik in 1967, and he makes the following request, in source 26. He says to his rabbi, proclaim a religious festival. Proclaim God's revelatory presence in history. Must God only be revealed in stories? Can we not celebrate the living God of our directly felt redemption? Rav Soloveitchik responded by referring to a Talmudic passage that says the festival of Hanukkah, which celebrates the Maccabean victory and the miracle of light, was not proclaimed immediately after these wondrous events, but rather only in the following year. Pointing out the significance of the words the following year, Rav Soloveitchik counseled me to wait and not to react in the heat of the excitement. His sobriety and restraint were out of tune with the enthusiasm and passion I felt as a result of the experience of liberation. I passionately wished to respond religiously to events, whereas he chose to be satisfied with worship mediated by halakhic sobriety. Now, he makes Aliyah in 1971, and thank you some people who were. He says he rediscovered what he calls the age-old experience of Jewish history, uncertainty, you know, loneliness, isolation, concern for survival. Those things sound familiar these past few weeks, especially in the aftermath of the Yom Kippur War. And he said he felt like writing back to Rav Soloveitchik that maybe you're right, maybe we have to wait before giving an enthusiastic religious response to events in history. But despite that sort of later recalibration, he really remained at odds with the Rav's halakhic methodology. He wanted more activism in every sphere. So you know what? We seem to be at an impasse. And much of this depends on your perspective. So I'm going to throw out a bunch of questions for you to meditate in your own time. Is Rav Soloveitchik's vision of life one of tragic inwardness and ultimate frustration? And are we going to be in a kind of endless exile from ourselves and God, regardless of how history plays out? Or is Rav Soloveitchik attempting to really give us some existential honesty while acknowledging the need and genuine potential for relationships, but mediated by halakha, and therefore not available to people outside of the covenant? Or is he framing a meaningful life in too narrow a way? Or is he simply adamant that from a Jewish point of view, a real connection with others, a relationship that's worthy of the name, requires a baseline similarity of halakhic and spiritual worldviews, and that it's politically correct, but ultimately false, to pretend that we can really communicate to others who do not share our most cherished beliefs and life goals? On the other side, is Rabbi Hartman accurately and courageously calling the bluff on an insular community that has betrayed the best of what Judaism is about, and has failed to recognize the opportunities that history has afforded us? Is he demonstrating enormous moral principle in taking on his mentor? Or is it basically an arrogant inability to bend his will to the will of the historical halakha? Is Rav Soloveitchik locked into an historical kind of mythical vision of an unchanging halakha, Or is Rabbi Hartman expecting far too much? The teacher taking him out of context, applying standards to him that are unrealistic, using the Rav's words just to launch into a full-scale attack on orthodoxy, in which he, Rabbi Hartman, can no longer quiet himself. I don't know the answer to a single one of these questions. But as the old joke has it, if I have to decide between the two sides, the answer is yes. In other words, I can see it both ways. From Soloveitchik and the world he inhabits, the world he portrays, and yes, the world he perhaps romanticizes, definitely does not measure up to the kind of halachic and social activism that Rabbi Hartman takes to be the key to redemption. And yet, Rabbi Soloveitchik's discourse within his frame of reference was honest, was radical, was, yes, activist, in trying to discuss Judaism in a way that would make it move forward and appeal to a wider sensibility that was also very, very traditional. In the era where he arose, he wrote, and he taught. And what's called his paralysis can also be seen as a clear-eyed, pragmatic sense of what happens when halakha becomes eroded and Judaism no longer speaks the language of non-negotiable imperatives. On the other hand, Rabbi Hartman's vision is bold, it's forward-looking, it's intense, it's idealistic. He's also passed off by people who don't like him or don't agree with him, who use all sorts of cliched language to dismiss him. He's a rebel against halakha, he's a heretic, he's no longer orthodox, none of which is really a meaningful criticism. And these criticisms are put forward the better to not to have to actually engage with his real ideas and his real challenges. So for me, the reason I've gone through this back and forth is that for me, the very nature of the argument, what it represents, distance, the harshness between different Jewish sensibilities, the seeming lack of a way for those differences to be communicated and to be mutually influential, that may be the most significant legacy of the debate. And that may be the real government. The German Israeli philosopher Ernst Simon once famously wrote, "The people I can pray with, I can't talk to. And the people I can talk to, I cannot pray with." It could be that our real Jewish exile lies not in geography and not in history and not in some sort of cosmic displacement, but our inability to sit down with one another and share our religious disagreements, talk them out intelligently, see the subtleties in our similarities, and see the wisdom in our differences. You know, people in modern orthodoxy or dati lumi or sorati or whatever words you want to give it, we tend to get a bit snobbish this way. We pride ourselves as being more open-minded, you know, than those supposedly closed-minded Haredim, etc. But from what I've seen, and from where I sit, there's plenty of entrenched attitudes all the way around. Plenty of room for all communities to recognize views that are not their own and positions that challenge them and force them to rethink. And that's true of Jews across the world, and it's emphatically true in this country, because issues have to be understood with nuance and with patience. That's the one belief we now face, is seeming an unbridgeable gap between people, our inability to talk about Judaism with those with whom we do not agree. But that exile, the exile of one Jew from his neighbor, is really just a gateway to other kinds of kavod, and this is what I want to conclude on. The distance between human beings and God, and the alienation of people from themselves. Maybe that's what we mean by the loss of paradise. Adam and Chava are exiled from the garden, and they represent the end of innocence and perfection, and they prefigure the loss not just of a physical home, but of the loss of God. Jewish and Western sources trace continuously this kind of mythic longing that human beings have to go back to something, to return to where? To what? We have never recovered from that mythic loss. Not even after Sinai. Because after Sinai, we now mediate the relationship with God with things, with Torah, with mitzvot, with texts, with objects, with rituals. We use intermediaries including the Torah. If you look at source 27, it's sort of put very succinctly by the French philosopher Jacques Derrida, who alludes to this inability to ever regain presence, when he writes, "The sign is always a sign of the fall." What does Derrida mean? The sign is always a sign of the fall. In Eden, Adam is entirely in consonance with God's will. There is no requirement to convey God's reality through any kind of other means. God is present without language, without symbol, without signs, without the need for interpretation. Kevin Hart, in Source 28, fleshes this out a bit. After Eden, no longer in harmony with God, this world becomes a chiaroscuro of presence and absence. Everywhere you look, there are signs of divine presence that is withdrawn and reveals itself only in those signs. So what Derrida indicates is that the very fact that you have a sign of something means quite simply you do not have the thing itself. Every sign, every representation of an object or a person or a god is the guarantor that the thing is elsewhere. Otherwise, why do you need to represent it? A sign is always a sign of the fall, that God is no longer present and must, as it were, be re-presented. Signs are substitutes for what we really want. An analogous way of thinking of this, for those who like literature, comes in Source 29, which comes from Emily Bronte's 1847 novel, Wuthering Heights. In that text, the bereaved Heathcliff yearns with every fiber of his being to reconnect to his childhood soulmate, Catherine Earnshaw, who has since died. He has a plan to do this, and it's as ingenious as it is ill-fated. He became wealthy, and Heathcliff decides what he's going to do is he's going to buy both houses that Catherine lived in and everything that's inside of them. He's going to take possession of all of it, and then he's going to destroy all of it, every last thing. Because his reasoning is that if he can acquire and then demolish everything that stands between him and Catherine, he'll be able to somehow reach her. Somehow find her presence now that nothing stands in the way, as it were. But of course, it's a completely doomed project. And late in the novel, Heathcliff rages against this bitter irony of being perpetually reminded of Catherine, when she's in fact not now, nor ever again to be actually present. And he says, "What is not connected with her to me, and what does not recall her? I cannot look down to this floor, but her features are shaped in the flags, in every cloud, in every tree, filling the air at night, and caught by glimpses in every object by day. I am surrounded by her image. The most ordinary faces of men and women, my own features mocking with resemblance. The entire world is a dreadful collection of memoranda that she did exist, and I have lost her." Look at that last line. "The entire world is a dreadful collection of memoranda that she did exist, and I have lost her." Which is a very powerful rendering of how the signs that are meant to recover that which they are signifying are the ultimate guarantee of their loss. That's the poignancy of a gravestone. Right, we erect gravestones and tend to them to create a sign of the departed. But the stone's presence, every time I look at that stone, is a reminder of the final confirmation of the beloved's absence. You know, observant Jews really do a version of people in their all-encompassing attempt to recover presence. You know, this quest for more and more and more and more halachic exactitude. You fine-tune precisely what the law expects, and then go further, and then go further. It's a kind of unspoken yet intuitive attempt to plug that unfillable gap, to reach across the universe, and through our Heathcliff-like exertions, shorten the distance between ourselves and the inevitable. Hoping, we hope against hope, that all of this halachic stringency will somehow convert into the remanifestation of God. In essence, we're looking for God who feels out of reach. That's a very thorny dilemma to work through. This general difficulty of this religious truth in a world where God is basically silent. And if you think about it, silence is a blessing and a curse, right? Because it allows for Jews to operate with a good deal of interpretive freedom without God breathing down their necks. But also creates an unceasing yearning for that which seems asking and hard to find. And ironically, it was the Rav's son, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, who probably put this at the best. In his essay in 1994, Rupture and Reconstruction. In the essay, it's a long essay with even longer footnotes, he painstakingly traces the turn towards a more stringent attitude towards halachah and orthodoxy. His thesis is that it became more stringent because people stopped worrying about halachah from living role models, like parents and teachers, and started learning it out of books. At the end of the essay, after talking about the massive impact of the scientific worldview and all kinds of explanations that we now offer for a wide variety of events, this is how he concludes in source 30. I think it is safe to say that the perception of God as a daily natural force is no longer present to a significant degree in any sector of modern Judaism, even the most religious. It is this rupture in the traditional religious sensibilities that underlies much of the transformation of contemporary Orthodoxy. Zealous to continue traditional Judaism unimpaired, religious Jews seek to ground their new emerging spirituality less on a now unattainable intimacy with Him than on an intimacy with His will, avidly eliciting its intricate demands, saturating their daily lives with its exactions. Having lost the touch of His presence, they seek now solace in the pressure of His yoke. Beautiful passage. Right, there's much to say about this in no time, but you know, the imbalance alludes to the what we have now in traditional communities where we've substituted a certain kind of lack of stringency for spiritual connectedness, and an imbalance inside of us too. And much of what we try and do in life is trying to fill that gap that we feel, that gap between ourselves and whatever else, the unreachable, ungraspable object of our dreams. And that object could be anything. It could be the one you loved that is gone. It could be the past that you fantasize about that has faded. It could be the life that you think you should be living that remains unlived. The psychoanalyst Adam Phillips in Source 31, the last source, portrays this with moving accuracy in his recent work. Phillips argues that a great deal of our inner mental life, what we carry around daily and forever, is about the lives we are not living, the lives we could be leading, for some reason or not. And he writes, our unlived lives, the lives we live in fantasy, the wished for lives, are often more important to us than our so-called lived lives. What we fantasize about, what we long for, are the experiences, the things, and the people that are absent. We learn to live somewhere between the lives we have and the lives we would like. And there is always what will turn out to be the life we live, and the life that accompanied it, the parallel life, our lives, that never actually happened, that we lived in our minds, the wished for life, the risks untaken, and the opportunities avoided or uncompliant. We refer to them as our unlived lives because somewhere we believe that they were open to us, but for some reason they were not possible. And what was not possible all too easily becomes the story. And perhaps this last is the worst element of them all. The exile of not being present to ourselves, where our lived lives become a kind of protracted avelut, protracted mourning for the lives we're unable to live. To close, I know that Tisha B'Av is usually discussed in this kind of macroscopic, almost apocalyptic way. Rebuilding of the temple, the coming of the Messiah, and ushering in of a new age of peace. But I've never been very good with the macro. And so in this talk and in others, I've tried to learn my teaching forward with
the microphone. So I'm going to finish, as always, with a few questions that we can walk with. How can I become more present to myself? How can I bridge the gap between the life I'm preoccupied with in my mind and the one that I'm actually living? How can I contribute more meaningfully and lovingly to the Jewish community of which I am a part? And to those people and ideas that I've heard of secondhand, but that I am sure I do not agree with, and are not fashionable in my circle, do I really understand them? Have I read them firsthand? Have I ever met or spoken with the person to whom those views are attributed? What do I really believe in? And when was the last time I thought about it? Do I live in consonance with my deepest beliefs and with awareness of other people's? And is the Judaism that we practice truth-seeking, inspirational, compassionate? Or is it sloppy, uncommitted, judgmental, hypocritical? A lot of questions, not so many answers. Anyway, may we all have the courage to engage each other in truly life-enhancing ways and begin to find keys to our ultimate index. Thank you for coming.
And Kierkegaard are all existentialists. And you said that I don't consider him really so much as an existentialist. But in number 21, Judaism has always held that it lies within man's power to renew himself, to rededicate his course of life, that the man himself has a strength, like Sartre says, to renew himself. Didn't he say, if he says that, can't you consider him an existentialist?
He's not the same kind of existentialist as those to whom he's usually compared. There's obviously points of similarity, and there are points where this world be very much like a Venn diagram kind of touches upon things that they say, but I try to point out there are elements that make him distinctly Jewish and unique from that tradition. One more.
So to go to the 935 convention, the rabbinical assembly, So I remember reading Billy Hayes' life a while ago, and I think when Hoffman is talking about how he's puzzled and disappointed by some of Edgerton's comments, he's saying, I think, that there are other times when Soloveitchik seems to be more flexible with these things. So is that the case from your understanding that there's something in it? It's not just that Soloveitchik went against this particular idea, but there was something inconsistent in his objection to it. That at other times he was willing to see Kazakov as social construction.
Yeah. So the question is whether in the objection to Soloveitchik's repudiation of Rabbi Rakin's Aguda was whether he wasn't being inconsistent with his own forwardness in other black areas. So there's a bunch of things to say. First of all, I never met Rabbi Soloveitchik, never met Rabbi Herman, saw him once in a lecture here in Jerusalem in 1985. So I'm not one of those who's an insider. Number two, Rabbi Soloveitchik is really not known primarily as a he's not published Pisei Halacha the way somebody like Moshe Feinstein or other people do. My real sense of the matter is that Rabbi Harbin is deeply disappointed in what he wanted him to be. And I think that the disappointment, again, I'm only saying this from reading, but the disappointment stems from, in a sense, a kind of misreading of the Rav's quote-unquote boldness. Because the Rav's boldness is always circumscribed in a very, very traditional world of his fathers. What he did differently, you know, that Rav Chaim of Brisk did not do, right, is do his doctorate in Berlin, you know, on Hermann Cohen, and go into fields intellectually that nobody in his family, you know, did before him. But I don't think that fundamentally meant that he was going to be part of a kind of postmodern pluralist age. It's complete misreading of terms and grafting of one kind of boldness onto another kind of boldness. I don't say that judgmentally. I respect both notions, actually, of boldness. And I think very much in many ways part of the problem with us, the lay people, is that we put too much on people before us to represent views that we now want to be held, instead of saying they didn't hold them, and maybe they couldn't hold them, but does that mean we can't? Right? What we do a lot in religious communities is we say, that person doesn't say the Holocaust like that. He should have. Because if he did, then I would feel authority for what I'm doing. The real question is, what do you do when you reach the moment when you realize they did sanction, they won't sanction, they couldn't have sanctioned? So are you going to surrender to that, change it, right? That's part of the, that's why I say that I think it's silly to call Chazal out for not being feminists, right? You should not Chazal, you should use us. Right? They are who they are, they were who they were, they did what they did. It was the revolutionary project in the history of Judaism. It saved Jewish life in the wake of the destruction of the temples. But that Reish Lakish doesn't sound like Gloria Steinem, that's a problem? It's not a problem for Reish Lakish, it's not a problem for Gloria Steinem. Right? It's our problem to figure out how to negotiate in the wake of the Milchamash HaTorah, the War of Torah. Right? So I think that Rabbi Hartman really, really wanted Rabbi Soloveitchik to go the extra step. He didn't. Maybe he couldn't. And I think it's perfectly fine to feel a sense of disappointment, because for him this was the man. You know, and he really wanted that authority behind their experience. I think his criticisms are sharp, and I think they're worth taking extremely seriously. The only thing I'm pointing out here is that I think that it's important to view people in the context in which they live, and write, and think. And if we don't like it, then we have to go one better. Yeah.
Well, not on halacha, but on inconsistency, perhaps, in Russell of Aitchik. I mean, I was, the source people that I was most shocked by was source number 16, which for me feels really inconsistent with a lot of other things that Russell of Aitchik says. In source number 16, it starts to sound like sort of a parody of astrology, saying the masses cannot have morality. It's not sort of underpinned by a metaphysical transcendental source. Then again, in most of the other work, you will say, well, no, we can stand shoulder to shoulder with everyone when forming secular society, which in many ways, I think, makes Russell of Aitchik more apt to work in sort of a liberal framework than technical argument. So how do we explain what he says here?
Look, I think that the attack on secular morality is really very much, it's almost a garden variety orthodox critique of moral relativism. It hasn't been shocked by it at all. And I think, again, it's a kind of misreading if we expect him to. I think we misunderstand what Rav Soloveitchik understands by modernity, right? In other words, his modernity is a very unique kind of modernity in which the spiritual person is unflanked by this kind of scientific mechanistic worldview that arose since the Enlightenment and experiences a kind of loneliness. And his other figures is kind of halakhic hero who God gave the wherewithal to create halakhic worlds. And I think what happened in the second figure is that Rabbi Hartman looks at halakhic hero as a halakhic man. The rhetoric is very much a creation. Like the halakhic man is going to create worlds. So I think for Rabbi Hartman, it was like, timeless. Okay, good. So now maybe it's like halakha here. Let's create new things. And I think for Rabbi Soloveitchik, it was no. We're going to create a kedushin, a chiddush, a toskot. We're going to create like that hapa megemara. I wasn't thinking about recreating actual modern halakha in that sense. It certainly didn't write in that way. So I think that there's a promise that's held out of a certain kind of modernity there that's interpreted in another way. It doesn't happen that way. But I'm not shocked at all by 16. In fact, that is exactly the kind of sort of absolutist moral critique you get, not just in Judaism. All Western-based monotheistic faiths argue on the premise that without God, morality is relative and henceforth nameless.
course, but then, of course, in, for example, the early man of faith, he will, for example, in a sort of dig, for example, Martin Buber say, well, the majestic man, he can perfectly live within the realm of the I and that. So the problem.
Yeah.
So it's not amoral.
Jewish philosophy in many ways, I mean, non-Jewish, non-religious Jewish philosophy ends up being an antinomy. I mean, Martin Buber doesn't care about halacha. Martin Buber is a very sexy figure for people going to university and take Jewish philosophy because they're drawn by the fact they don't have to be constrained by halacha. You can speak the language university, but the rabbi is entrenched in the halachic world that he grew up with, that he believes is the way to go. So he's actually navigating a much narrower place, right, where you're trying to be both bold and yet constrained. But who's more constrained, Maimonides or Spinoza? Right? And obviously the answer is Maimonides, right? Anybody who actually tries to do something creative but is tethered to a tradition that they feel they have to protect, defend, uphold, transmit, is obviously going to have less freedom to just say what you want and do what you want than for somebody who there are no strings left and to say and do what I want. So it's always going to be more difficult to be a kind of bold thinker when you're working within certain kinds of constraints. But that was his thought, that's what he did. I'm interested in the aftermath of the kind of argument between the two men and what it represents for the kinds of discussions that we don't have in Judaism today. Because I think the model of the argument is important. I think the attitudes on both sides are serious and intelligent and informed. And it's a pity they couldn't be tied together. But the legacy of it is something that I think we need to keep to do now. And we need to pick up that thread and do it now.